I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually, the end of the world. Welcome to the weekend edition, and before we get started, I want to invite you once again to post your comments, audio comments about the Are You Serious show at areyouseriousradio.com. Also, we are going away for a week. But we will be back, and hopefully we will do several weeks of shows in a row. You never know about that, but we'll try to do that. Meanwhile, we've got Jeff Deal and the immortal destiny of Destinyland and the place where fame hurts. Mm-hmm. And not everybody was protesting and sticking it to the man in the 60s. Some people were, in fact, watching cartoons. Middle American kids were curled up blithely in front of their TV sets watching Saturday morning favorites like Scooby-Doo and Puff and Stuff, but were they still getting their freak on? Destiny remembers some pretty weird shit coming over the airwaves. Somehow it seemed like distorted echoes of the counterculture were sneaking into the cartoons themselves. All the characters suddenly belonged to groovy, tuned-in rock bands, including the Flintstones. And there were hippie bears on the Hair Bear Lunch.
The Hair Bear Bunch.
Hair Bear Bunch, that's what I said. And Flying Flower Children's on the Boogaloos.
They had a top 40 hit single, I think, too.
And believe it or not, there was a show called Lizville by 1971. For those of you who don't remember, a lid used to be, I think, 2.2 ounces of marijuana. PBS had even launched a hip new show to make reading fun, and they had young Morgan Freeman, playing a character named Easy Reader, and they were not sued by Peter Fonda or Dennis Hopper. So anyway, the revolution was not televised, but the cartoons were fun, and maybe we can guess why Shaggy and Scooby-Doo were always so hyperactive, always saw ghosts, and always had the munchies.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? I mean, someone once made the point that, like, you had this van driving around the country, and you had four young people, and none of them had jobs or homes or families. They're just cruising around, going from place to place, getting in trouble, and feeding snacks to their dog, and giggling a lot, and being kind of hyperactive. Someone on the web actually wrote this Marxist film critique of Scooby-Doo. And they said, well, you know, they were trying to sort of prepare the proletariat for the coming revolution by having these very, very innocuous young people who nonetheless did not hold jobs and who did travel around and who consumed mysterious substances which gave them the powers to fight ghosts. And
would that be a Marxist analysis or more like a slacker hippie?
yeah, I think it would be Marxist.
That might have led to the slacker generation, actually.
I went back and read that on the internet. It was some college kids' like paper for their media studies class. So, but you know, I guess a lot of Marxists just end up being college students with a lot of time in their hands. The weirdest one for me was like I was there in the 60s, man. But I was like 6 years old, and nonetheless, there'd be things that would happen that were really strange. The teacher passes out the weekly reader in first grade, and there's a big story. On Saturday mornings, there's going to be a new show, and it stars monkeys, live monkeys, Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp. So I figured I had to watch it because they were talking about it in first grade. He was like a spy. You know, he worked for the Agency to Prevent Evil, which was APE if you spelled it out. And it was like a sitcom. They had like a laugh track and everything. But about 10 minutes into the show, they'd stop and they'd say, okay, kids, now Monkey's going to play a little song for you. And then they had this mirror ball spinning around, and the one monkey's got an electric guitar, and the other one sort of, she's got like long hair like Linda McCartney, and she's banging a tambourine on her hip. And, I mean, the tune really rocked. I found out later on it was by the Grassroots, who were like a real 60s band. They had like 12 top 40 hits.
They lived for today.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they had a Midnight Confession. I mean, you know, a lot of songs you've heard of were by the Grassroots, and then by night they go in and go, okay, we gotta dub the Monkey Band now. Let's go. Hit it. And I'm watching this. I'm 6 years old. I'm like, why is this Monkey Band called the Evolution Revolution? Why do they want me to let my hair down? Why are they singing these things? You'd have this sort of ersatz child's version of the counterculture because that was hip and relevant, and they thought that maybe your big brother would want to watch it with you or something. But it wasn't just like the Monkey Band. Like every cartoon you tuned into had some kind of weird ass rock band. There was Josie and the Pussycats. There was Grooly Ghoulies. They had a cartoon based on Charlie Chan, and it was the Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan, and all his kids together collectively formed some kind of Chinese rock band. You had Jabberjaws. Yeah, I mean, I made a big list at one point in time. The Flintstones had already kind of gone off the air, but they brought back
Bam Bam and Pebbles.
Yeah,
started a band. And I vaguely remember that actually.
Yeah. They were teenagers now, and it would have been okay, except like for Pebbles, they got like Sally Struthers to do the voice.
Bam Bam is a great name. Actually, they're both great names for rock stars.
Yeah, actually,
it sounds similar to the phenomenon of everything in kids' culture. You know, having a hip hop element. You know, like remember. A decade or so ago, everything was rap, you know, right. Like really bad commercials. And every cartoon, you had somebody doing really bad raps, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, actually, my friend Andy always talks about how they had a series of horror movies called Leprechaun, where the leprechaun terrorizes people. And then the sequel came out with Leprechaun, Lep in Da Hood. And in the closing credits, the leprechaun does a rap number. Lep in Da Hood, come to do no good. So I guess, yeah, maybe that's the children's television programming is sort of the last frontier for bad ideas. It's where they go to die. I mean, not only were there like rock bands, but there were also like cartoons based on rock bands. So the Beatles had a cartoon. The Osmonds had a cartoon.
Right.
Jackson 5 had a cartoon. The Partridge Family in the Year 2020 cartoon. Brady Kids.
Did you ever see that one?
I you know, even at the age of 7, I'm like, I don't even like the Brady Bunch when they're live. Why would I like them as a cartoon? Hmm. I saw a few of those. I mean, the best thing.
What is that? You said Partridge Family. Was it Partridge or Brady?
Believe it or not, they had to compete. Like, yeah, well, we'll have a cartoon with our own TV sitcom family band. So they were competing. The Partridge Family had to fight the Brady Bunch. And I would pay good money to see that fight, actually. But what was really weird is like 20 years later, they made a Brady Bunch movie where the Brady kids had they had three girls, three boys, and this talking bird that could fly by pulling his tail feathers, and he also had like a magic. He could do magic, some kind of trippy, psychedelic, like sort of stoner type bird. So 20 years later, they made a movie based on the Brady Bunch TV show, and at one point in time, they actually worked in a scene where Alice goes through like the guest's luggage and finds some exotic mushrooms, which she assumes are cooking supplies, and cooks up into a casserole. And then the guy actually eats the mushrooms and starts tripping out, and what does he see? He sees the Brady Bunch cartoon from the 70s with the bird with the magic hat that could fly.
So that's actually real, because I saw that was posted on Dose Nation, and I didn't even look at it because I assumed it was some kind of parody.
Yeah, well, I mean, the 90s movie was a parody of the 70s TV show, but the cartoon itself actually was more or less a recreation of the actual trippy cartoon they had. I mean, that's the thing. If you go back and watch these things, they're really pretty trippy. Someone once said that, like, cartoon theme songs actually became folk songs for people in the 80s. You go to college and you got nothing in common. There's not the unity you had in the 60s, but what you do have is that you have... everyone, like some documentary maker went back to Kent State in the 80s and he's asked people, so, you know, what do you believe in? What would you fight for? And they're like, I don't know. It's the 80s. I guess they just want to get a good job. And then he said, okay, well, do you know all the words to the Brady Bunch theme? Oh, yeah, yeah. Here we go. And he had like footage of like 20 different kids and they're all going through the Brady Bunch theme. We know that backwards and forwards. They never renounced their consumer stylehood, I guess. But I don't know. There's something else in the 60s. Lyndon Johnson launched the Great Society, and when he was president, you know, he was going to wipe out poverty. And part of that was they created PBS. And the first show they came up with was Sesame Street. I watched the first episode of that. And the mission of Sesame Street was to make sure that like poor kids could compete with rich kids when they got to school. You know, you'd try to improve their reading skills, give them that head start, teach them the alphabet, that kind of thing. And later on, they said, we're going to do a show for, you know, little older kids, The Electric Company. And their mission was to make it, you know, hipper. We need to have a PBS show that's hip, that's cutting edge. And this is like 1971, 72. So they borrowed a lot of stuff from the counterculture. They said that they wanted to have a character that would make reading cool. So they brought in like Morgan Freeman, and they said, we're going to make him a junkie for reading.
And did they actually use the term junkie in the show? Or?
Well, there's one line where he says, I'm in need for something to read. And you've talked to him now he's a big star, he's very respected, and he really gets really tired of people asking him about when he was Easy Reader. Even back then, he said, I was scared to death that the image of me as an old man would be, I'd be staggering down the street, followed by a bunch of little kids shouting, hey, there goes Easy Reader. And it's kind of an embarrassing character. I mean, he did a really good job, you know, with the performances that he did on The Electric Company, but at the same time, I mean, he even said it was kind of like wearing golden handcuffs. You know, you get trapped by the money thing. I was there on The Electric Company for about 3 years too long. That's what it says in Wikipedia. And Bill Cosby left after the first season. So, I don't know. The other thing that's interesting about that is that, like, there was a guy named Skip on that show. Skip Hynand. He was one of the six people. He played Fargo North, Decoder. And later on, he did a voice on My Little Pony. But little known fact, he was also the voice of Fritz the Cat. In fact, within a few years of each other, he's like Fritz the Cat going, man, I really want to ball that chick in the bathtub. And then he's like teaching kids how to pronounce the silent E in a word. And now he's like sort of leader of an actors union in New York.
They're like some kind of continuum between kids' cartoons and what later became adult cartoons. Because it's interesting to me because people above a certain age, which I guess now would be into their 60s, cannot get the idea that some of these shows are for grown-ups and that they're serious satire, or I mean they're funny satire, but they're just, you know, they just cannot look at animation.
They work on two levels sometimes. I mean, that's my theory about where all this came from. I was asking myself that. I think the thing is that the people writing the cartoons, you got to ask, what were they trying to get across? And who do you hire to write your cartoons in 1971? Well, you hire someone as close to kid age as you can. You hire a lot of hip 20-somethings to sort of crank these things out. We were talking before about like Bugs Bunny. I mean, it's sort of the gold standard for a cartoon. I think the thing about that is that, like, originally cartoons were done by like MGM, 20th Century Fox, big studios, the people that would throw money at The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. They'd take a chunk of money and they'd throw it at like making a really nicely animated cartoon with good plots, good vocal talent. And they were shown before the movies to everybody, to adults, to kids. So I think that eventually that got lost. Eventually you started having TV cartoons made just for kids. And there was a sort of this 15-year period of experimentation where they tried to figure out what would work and what wouldn't work for kids. And at some point in time, they were actually sort of still doing a general audiences kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of passion and creativity. Who's the guy who did the stuff for Disney? I mean, they took that pretty seriously.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. Was it Harriman?
That could be.
Harriman did Crazy Cat. I don't know if that was Disney or not.
I remember Crazy Cat. Crazy Cat's kind of trippy in its own right, too. I mean, the other thing is that a lot of things in the 40s and 50s that were really trippy and out there kind of found a new audience in the 60s.
Right.
Although, I mean, that's true of a lot of things. The Three Stooges found a new audience in the 60s, too. I think everyone found a new audience in the 60s. There were just a lot of people in the 60s. You had the baby boom. It was the biggest generation ever.
Also, if you're tripping, things become meaningful, even if they're not.
Yeah, that's actually my theory. I've always wondered if they were sort of trying to sneak things into the cartoons that would attract a college-age audience as well as a young audience. I mean, people have asked that about, like, Sid and Marty Krofft, right? You had, like, they did the Banana Splits. And they were pretty rocking in their own sense. You know, big animals and colorful costumes. And they had a rock band, too. And the rock band, you know, it wasn't singing kids' songs. It was singing songs about you gotta have soul. And so, you know, I mean...
gotta have soul.
Yeah, for Cartoon Gorilla...
That's a statement right there.
Especially from like a giant elephant or like a dog with glasses, you know. And I'm 5 years old, I'm watching this. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have a messed up childhood. I can already tell. But so what's weird is the five generations of puppeteers had gone through the 18th century and the early 1900s, and they'd passed on their skills from generation to generation until finally Sid and Marty Krofft find themselves with these puppetry skills in San Francisco in the late 1960s. And they were top in their field. They'd done puppet shows, you know, to open for Sinatra and Judy Garland and Liberace. And then they got tapped for this TV show for the Banana Splits. And then since they had made the contact, they said, we're going to do our own show. And that was H.R. Puffin Stuff, who was this giant green dragon. And
there's quite a name, Puffin Stuff.
Yeah. And he lived in the Living Island. And everyone's asked, I mean, every show they did, that was the first one. And they did about five other shows. And everyone said, man, what were you guys on when you came up with those? You had all these colors and everything. Finally, in the 90s, there was a show called Mr. Show, and David Cross was on at a comedian. And,
yeah, great show. Yeah.
So they did a skit one time where they had Sid and Marty Croft, and they come on, they do a talk show, and they say, well, you know, the man was too afraid to show our master work, which was going to be called Drugachusetts. And then they actually did a skit about that where they had the opening theme to Drugachusetts, and then it was a lot like Puffin Stuff, and that's sort of the joke there, is that there really isn't much of a joke there, that really it was a lot like Puffin Stuff. You have this kid with these giant creatures running around, and then to even follow up on that one, I mean, when they made a movie based on Puffin Stuff, and they brought in like Mama Cass to play a witch and do sort of these really boffo, you know, sort of Ed Sullivan type songs where she really sort of stole the show. And Puffin Stuff had a band that was called The Birds. Only they were actual birds, though, giant with an eye, giant bird costumes walking around. And so then they got an even better idea. They said, our next show, it's going to be about a rock band. A flying flower children rock band, and they'll all have wings and antennas, and they'll live in a garden, the Tranquility Forest. And these were the Bugaloos, and their arch nemesis was named Bonita Bizarro, and she had like a Nazi chauffeur rat. Yeah, I mean, it was
that should be a real person. I mean, all those aspects would be great, like, you know, punk or.
Totally.
70s new wave person or something like that.
Yeah, every time I say all these things, I'm like, you know, that would be so cool to just like name your band Bam Bam, you know, after Pebbles and Bam Bam, or Bonita Bizarro, or I forget what the rat's name was. And so the Bugaloos even had like a top 40 hit too for a while. And here's a weird story. It's 1970, and the president of South Vietnam is at a hotel in San Francisco. And of course, you know, the protesters come from everywhere, from Berkeley and San Francisco, and they're starting to converge on the hotel where the president of South Vietnam is. And this is going to be an ugly scene. So then the cops turn up, and they got this police line getting set up. You know, you got to back off. You got to stay away from the president of South Vietnam. You know, let's make this an orderly protest. And there's tension back and forth. And all of a sudden, the doors of the hotel open, and out walks the Bugaloos with the antennas and the wings and the pink miniskirt. And they go, hi, everybody, we're the Bugaloos. Because they were in the same hotel, they were touring, and they had no idea there was a protest going on outside.
So they kept the peace.
Yeah, the Bugaloos kept the peace.
Kind of like James Brown during the riots, where it was in Chicago or something.
Is that true? I hadn't heard that story. The James Brown just said...
During the Martin Luther King riots, that he was giving a concert, and he kept the peace.
Huh.
Kind of like Steve Wozniak at the Apple Store in Santa Clara.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Steve is a cartoon character, I think.
Yeah, I always wonder sometimes if, like, all the cartoons I watch somehow, like, influence my personality, and I sort of grew up to be a bit of a cartoon character with the wacky vocal mannerisms and the gestures and the, uh-oh, what's going on here? And the general irresponsibility and the...
And the brightly colored skin and hair.
Yeah, zoing. And then the little light bulbs appear in my head sometimes.
Sound effects, yeah.
I'll tell you one more story. There's a website called Bugaloo.com, the world's longest fan site. I mean, this site went up in like 1997, so this guy's been doing his Bugaloo's fan site for 10 years. That's a serious diehard fan. What's even sadder is if you go to his webpage, it says, you are visitor number 391,000 since 1997. That's not a whole lot. That's maybe a couple hundred a month, something like that. But he's been keeping the faith. Like, I still love the Bugaloos. I still love the Bugaloos, especially the girl Bugaloo. She wore a pink miniskirt, and she was really cute. Her name was Joy on the show. They all had hippie names like IQ or Harmony or I forget what the other one was. And Joy was the female Bugaloo. And so this story kind of has a happy ending. I'm guessing you had a crush on Joy, just like everyone else watching the show. Every time I mention the Bugaloos, people say, "Ah, Joy, man, she was the cute one." I had this thing about Joy the Bugaloo for the longest time. So somehow it turns out that one day it happens. The guy with the Bugaloo fan website, somehow somebody finds his way to it, and he says, well, hey, that's my sister. Hey, I'll have her call you, man. And so all of a sudden, this guy sets up a fan page for the Bugaloos, and the next thing you know, the Bugaloos are calling him. And I guess I always want to believe that there's some kind of message there, that if you love your favorite TV shows, you know, long enough and strong enough, you know, they'll find their way back to you and tell you that they love you too.
There we have it. The Destiny Land-flavored version of the Are You Serious Weekend Edition. And fear not, we will be wrestling with serious Socratic questions in the future. Thanks.
love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?